impeccably and given no reason at all to doubt him. And Denis Mikhailovich, refusing to label the man a spy or a saboteur, even in his thoughts, took a decision.
"Let's have a cup of tea, and then I'll go and talk to the men," he declared with exaggerated cheerfulness, cracking his knuckles.
Istomin tore himself away from the map and gave a weary smile. He was just reaching out to his ancient disc-dial phone to summon his orderly when the phone started ringing. The two men glanced sharply at each other, startled. It was a week since they had heard that sound. If the duty orderly wanted to report something, he always knocked at the door, and no one else at the station could call the commandant directly.
"Istomin here," he said warily.
"Vladimir Ivanovich, I've got Tula station on the line,"
the operator jabbered.
"Only it's very hard to hear anything. I think it's our men, but the connection—"
"Just put it through, will you?"
the commandant roared, slamming his fist down hard on the desk and setting the telephone jangling pitifully. The startled operator fell silent, and Istomin heard crackling and rustling sounds in the earpiece, and a distant voice distorted beyond recognition. Elena turned away to the wall, hiding her tears. What more could she do to hold him back? Why was he so glad to grab the first opportunity to get away from the station, using that moth-eaten old excuse about orders from the command and punishment for desertion? What had she failed to give him? What else should she have done in all these 15 years in order to tame him? But here he was, longing to get back into the tunnels again, as if he hoped to find something out there apart from darkness, emptiness, and death. What was it he was looking for? Homer could hear her reproaches in his own head, as clearly as if she was speaking out loud. He felt mean and shabby, but it was too late to retreat now. He almost opened his mouth to apologize, to speak warm, tender words. But he choked, realizing that every word would only throw more fuel on the flames. And above Elena's head, Moscow cried. Hanging on the wall, lovingly set in a little frame, was a color photograph of Tver Street in a transparent shower of summer rain cut out of an old glossy calendar. At one time, a long time ago during his old wanderings round the metro, Homer had owned nothing but his clothes and that photo. Other men's pockets held crumpled pages with photos of naked beauties torn out of men's magazines. But for Homer, they couldn't take the place of a real, live woman, even for a few brief, shameful minutes. That photo reminded him of something that was infinitely important, inexpressibly beautiful, and lost forever. With an awkward whisper, "I'm sorry," he edged out into the corridor, carefully closed the door behind him, and squatted down, absolutely drained. The neighbor's door was ajar, and two puny, pasty-faced little children, a boy and a girl, were playing in the opening. Catching sight of the old man, they froze. The crudely sewn bear, stuffed with rags that they had just been arguing over, flopped to the floor, forgotten.
"Uncle Kolya, tell us a story. You promised you'd tell us one when you got back,"
they exclaimed, dashing at Homer.
"Which one do you want?" he asked, unable to refuse.
"About the mutants with no heads,"
the little boy howled gleefully.
"No, I don't want a story about mutants,"
the little girl exclaimed sulkily.
"They're frightening, I'm afraid."
"So which story do you want, Tanyusha?"
the old man sighed.
"In that case, the one about the fascists and the partisans,"
the little boy interrupted.
"No, I like the one about the Emerald City,"
Tanya said with a gap-toothed grin.
"But I told you that one only yesterday. Maybe the one about how Hansa fought the Reds."
"The Emerald City! The Emerald City!"
they both clamored.
"Oh, all right,"
the old man agreed.
"Somewhere far, far away, on the Sokolniki line, out beyond 7 empty stations, out beyond 3 ruined metro bridges, 1,000 sleepers away from here, lies a magical underground city. The city is enchanted, and ordinary people can't get into it. Magicians live there, and only they can come out through the gates of the city and go back in again. And up on the surface of the ground
is a huge, mighty castle with towers, where these wise magicians used to live. This castle is called
Diversity,
the little boy called out, giving his sister a triumphant look.
The University, Homer confirmed. When the Great War happened, and the nuclear missiles started raining down, the magicians withdrew into their city and put a spell on the entrance, so the wicked people who started the war wouldn't get in. And they live.
He gagged, and stopped. Elena was standing there, leaning against the doorpost and listening to him. Homer hadn't noticed her coming out into the corridor.
I'll pack your knapsack,
she said in a hoarse voice. The old man walked up to Elena and took her by the hand. She put her arms round him awkwardly, feeling shy in front of the neighbor's children, and asked,
Will you come back soon? Will you be all right?
And Homer, astounded for the thousandth time in his long life by the invincible female love of promises, regardless of whether it was possible to keep them or not, said,
Everything will be just fine.
You're so old already, but you kiss like you were a young couple,
said the little girl, making a spiteful face.
And our dad said it isn't true. There isn't any Emerald City,
the little boy said in a surly voice just to round things off.
Maybe there isn't, Homer said with a shrug. It's just a story. But how can we get by here without stories?
It was appallingly difficult to hear anything. The voice forcing its way through the crackling and rustling sounded vaguely familiar to Istomin, a bit like one of the team of three scouts sent to Serpukhov.
At Tula Station, we can't... Tula,
said the voice, straining to communicate something important.
I understand that you're at Tula,
Istomin shouted into the receiver.
What happened? Why don't you come back?
Tula Station. Here. Don't. It's very important. Don't.
But the end of the phrase was swallowed up by the damned interference.
Don't what? Say again. Don't what?
You mustn't storm it. Whatever you do, don't storm it.
The receiver suddenly said quite clearly and distinctly.
Why? What the devil is going on there? What's happening?
The commandant yelled impatiently. But he couldn't hear the voice any more. It was drowned in a massive surge of noise, and then the receiver went dead. But Istomin refused to believe it, and he wouldn't hang up.
What's happening?
Chapter 3 After Life. Homer thought he would never forget the look he got from the sentry who said goodbye to them at the most northerly guard post. It was the same look people give the body of a fallen hero as the honor guard fires that final volley in salute. A mournful, melancholy kind of look. Saying goodbye forever. Looks like that aren't meant for the living. Homer felt like he was climbing up a flimsy ladder into the cabin of a tiny plane that could take off but never land again, because devious Japanese engineers had converted it into a machine from hell. The Imperial banner fluttered in the salty wind, mechanics bustled about on the airfield, engines hummed and sprang to life, and a pot-bellied general held his fingers tight up against the peak of his cap, his puffy eyes glittering with samurai envy.
What's got you in such a tearful mood? Ahmed asked, shattering the old man's daydream.
Unlike Homer, he felt no urge to be first to discover what was going on at Serpukhov station. He had left his wife behind on the platform, brooding silently as she clutched their first child's little hand in her left hand and cradled their second child in her right arm, cautiously nestling the mewling bundle against her breast.
It's like drawing yourself up to your full height and launching yourself into the attack, charging the machine guns. The same feeling of reckless elation. We'll face a hail of deadly fire up ahead,
Homer tried to explain.
What you have is a different kind of attack, Ahmed muttered, looking back towards the little patch of light at the end of the tunnel. Custom made for psychos like you. No sane man would voluntarily go up against a machine gun. Who needs them heroics like that? Well, you see, it's like this,
the old man replied after a brief pause.
When you feel your time coming, you start thinking, have I really done anything? Will I be remembered?
I don't know about you, but I've got children. They'll remember me all right. The oldest, at least,
Ahmed added gravely after pondering for a moment. Homer was stung by that and felt he should make a sharp retort, but Ahmed's final words had blunted his battle further. It was true it was easy enough for an old man like him with no children to risk his moth-eaten skin, but the young man still had a long life ahead of him, too long to be concerned about immortality. They moved beyond the final lamp, a glass jar with a little electric bulb inside set in a frame of thin metal rods. It was full of singed flies and flying cockroaches. The chitinous mass was heaving slightly. Some of the insects were still alive and trying to crawl out like condemned prisoners who had fallen into the common trench with everyone else who was shot, but hadn't been finished off. Homer paused involuntarily for an instant in the spot of light that this lamp grave wrung out of itself, weak and yellow, flickering on the point of extinction. Then he filled his lungs with air and plunged on after the others into the ink-black gloom that extended from the boundary of Sebastopol all the way to the approaches to Tula, if, of course, any station with that name still existed. She wasn't alone, that somber woman with two little children, standing rooted to the granite slabs. The platform wasn't entirely deserted. A fat man with one eye and wrestler's shoulders was standing motionless some distance away, watching as the soldiers left, and one step behind him stood a sinewy old man in a private's pea jacket, talking quietly to an orderly.
All we can do now is wait,
Istomin declared, absent-mindedly switching a dead cigarette end from one corner of his mouth to the other.
You wait. I'll get on with my job,
the colonel retorted obstinately.
I tell you, that was Andrei, the leader of the team we sent out, said Istomin.
He listened once again to the telephone receiver voice still clamoring insistently in his head.
So now what? Maybe they forced him to say that under torture. The specialists know all sorts of different methods,
said the old man, raising one eyebrow.
It didn't seem like that,
said the commandant, shaking his head thoughtfully.
You should have heard the way he said it. There's something else going on there, something inexplicable, something we can't fix with a brisk cavalry sortie. I'll give you an explanation as quick as a wink, the colonel assured him. Tula's been captured by bandits. They set up an ambush and killed our men, or took some as hostages. They don't cut off the power because they use it themselves, and they don't want to get on the wrong side of Hansa. But they cut off the phone. What weird sort of business is that? A phone that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't.
But his voice, the way it sounded, said Istomin, sticking to his point.
What way did it sound?
The colonel exploded, making the orderly move back a few steps.
Stick pins under your nails, and we'll see what your voice sounds like, and with a simple pair of pliers you can change a bass to a falsetto for the rest of a man's life.
Everything was already clear to him. He had made his choice. And having resolved all his doubts, he felt as if he were back on his steed, and his cavalryman's hand was itching for the saber, no matter how dismally Istomin might whinge. The commandant took his time before answering, giving the colonel a chance to cool off.
We'll wait,
he said at last, amicably but firmly.
2 days,
said the old man, crossing his arms.
2 days,
said Istomin, nodding.
The colonel spun round on the spot and tramped off to the barracks. He wasn't going to waste the precious hours ahead. The commanders of the assault units had been waiting for him at HQ for the best part of an hour, lined up along both flanks of the long planking table. The only empty chairs were at the opposite ends, his and Istomin's. But this time they would have to start without the commandant. The station commandant didn't notice that Denis Mikhailovich had gone.
It's amusing, the way our roles have switched over, isn't it?
Said Istomin, perhaps talking to himself, perhaps to the colonel. Swinging round without waiting for a reply, he encountered the orderly's embarrassed glance and waved his arms to dismiss him.
I don't recognize the same colonel who refused to let me have a single extra man, the commandant thought. The old war dog has scented something, but is that nose of his leading him astray?
Istomin's own gut feeling told him something quite different. Lie low. Wait. The strange phone call had only intensified his dark premonition. At Tula, their heavy infantry would come face to face with a mysterious, invincible adversary. Vladimir Ivanovich rummaged through his pockets, found a cigarette lighter and struck a spark. And while the ragged smoke ring still rose into the air above his head, he stayed there, rooted to the spot, with his eyes riveted to the dark cavity of the tunnel, gazing spellbound at it, like a rabbit staring into the beckoning jaws of a boa constrictor. When he finished the cigarette, he shook his head again and set off to his office. The orderly emerged out of the shadows and followed him at a respectful distance. A dull click, and the ribbed vaulting of the tunnel was illuminated for a good 50 meters ahead. Hunter's flashlight was so large and powerful it was more like a searchlight. Homer breathed a silent sigh of relief. For the last few minutes he had been tormented by the stupid idea that the brigadier wouldn't switch on the light because his eyes could manage perfectly well without it. Once he set foot in the dark stretch of tunnel, the brigadier had started looking even less like an ordinary man, or any kind of man at all. His movements had acquired a graceful, impetuous, animal quality. It seemed as if he had switched on the flashlight for his companions, but he himself was relying on different senses. He often took off his helmet and turned one ear towards the tunnel, listening carefully, and even bolstered Homer's suspicions by stopping dead now and then to draw in the rusty-smelling air through his nose. Hunter glided along soundlessly several steps ahead of the others without looking round at them, as if he had forgotten they even existed. Ahmed was baffled. He didn't often stand watch at the southern frontier post, and he wasn't used to the brigadier's eccentricities. He prodded Homer in the side, as if to ask, "What's wrong with him?" The old man just shrugged. How could he explain that in a couple of words? What did Hunter need them for, anyway? He was the one who had cast Homer in the role of native guide, but he seemed far more at home in these tunnels than the old man. Of course, if he were asked, Homer could have told him a lot about the places around here, tall tales and true ones, which were sometimes far more fantastic and terrifying than the most incredible yarns spun by bored sentries sitting round a lonely campfire. He had his own map of the metro in his head, nothing at all like Istomin. Where the station commandant's map had yawning gaps, Homer could have filled all the blank space with his own markings and explanations. Vertical shafts, service facilities standing open or closed up and mothballed, spider webs of connecting tunnels between the main lines. On his map, along the stretch of tunnel between Chertanova and Southern, just 2 stations down from Sebastopol, a branch line budded off and merged into the gigantic bulge of the Warsaw Metro Depot, criss-crossed with the fine veins of dozens of dead ends and drainage tunnels. For Homer, with his reverential awe of trains, the depot was an eerie and mystical place, like an elephant's graveyard. The old man could talk about it for hours at a time, if only he could find listeners willing to believe him. Homer regarded the line between Sebastopol and Nakhimov Prospekt as very tricky. The rules of safety and plain common sense required them to stick together, moving slowly and cautiously, examining the walls and the floor ahead of them closely. Even in this stretch of tunnel where all the hatches and cracks had been bricked up and triple-sealed by engineering teams from Sebastopol, on no account could they afford to leave their rear uncovered. The darkness, sliced open by the beam of the flashlight, closed up again right behind their backs, the echoes of their footsteps fractured as they were reflected off the reinforcing ribs of countless sections of tunnel lining, and somewhere in the distance the wind howled, trapped in the ventilation shafts. Large, viscous drops gathered in cracks in the ceiling and fell. Perhaps they were just water, but Homer tried to dodge them, not for any particular reason. Just in case.
In olden times, when the bloated monster of a city on the surface still lived its own feverish life, and the restless city-dwellers still thought of the metro as a soulless transport system, back in those days the youthful Homer, who everyone still called Kolya, used to wander through the tunnels with a flashlight and a metal toolbox. Entry to those places was barred to ordinary mortals, whose access was restricted to the 150 or so marble halls, polished to a high gleam, and the congested carriages pasted with bright-coloured advertisements. The millions of people who spent 2 or 3 hours in the rumbling, swaying trains every day were unaware that they were only permitted to see a mere tenth of this incredibly vast underground kingdom that extended far and wide below the surface. And to make sure they didn't start speculating about its true size and where all those inconspicuous little doors and iron shutters led to, or where the dark little branch lines and connecting passages closed for never-ending repairs actually went, they were distracted by pictures bright enough to dazzle their eyes, provocatively stupid slogans and wooden-voiced commercials that prevented them from relaxing on the escalators. At least, that was how it seemed to Kolya, after he first started penetrating the secrets of this state within a state. The frivolous, rainbow-coloured schematic of the metro that hung in the carriages was intended to convince the curious that they were looking at an exclusively civilian system, but in reality, its cheerfully coloured lines were intertwined with the invisible branches of secret tunnels from which military and state bunkers dangled like bunches of grapes. And some stretches of tunnel linked up with the tangled catacombs dug under the city by ancient pagans. During the early days of Kolya's youth, when his country was too poor to vie with the power and ambition of others, Judgment Day had seemed very far off, and the bunkers and shelters built in anticipation of its arrival had gathered dust. But money brought the return of former arrogance, and with it, of enemies. The rust-coated, multi-ton doors of cast iron were opened again with a rasping creak. The stocks of food and medications were renewed. The air and water filters were rendered fully operational. And all just in the nick of time. For Kolya, a poor young man from out of town, to be accepted for a job in the metro was like joining a Masonic lodge. It transformed him from an unemployed reject into a member of a powerful organization that paid generously for the modest services he was able to provide and promised to initiate him into the arcane mysteries of the universe. The wages offered in the job announcement seemed very tempting to Kolya, and almost no requirements were specified for would-be trackwalkers. It was some time before he began to understand, from the reluctant explanations of his new colleagues, just why the Metropolitan was obliged to entice employees with high salaries and bonus payments for occupational hazards. It wasn't a matter of a heavy schedule or the voluntary renunciation of daylight. No, it had to do with dangers of an entirely different kind. Homer had a skeptical mind. He didn't believe in the ever-present dark rumors of ghosts and ghouls. But one day, his friend failed to return from checking a short dead-end stretch of tunnel, and for some reason, they didn't bother to search for him. The shift foreman just shrugged helplessly, and his friend's disappearance was followed by the disappearance of all the documents testifying that he had ever worked in the metro. Kolya was the only one still so young and naive that he refused to accept this disappearance, and eventually one of his senior colleagues whispered in his ear, gazing around as he did it, that his friend had been taken. So who, if not Homer, should know that bad things used to happen in Moscow's subterranean depths long before life in the megalopolis died, scorched by the withering breath of Armageddon? After losing his friend, and being initiated into forbidden knowledge like that, Kolya could have taken fright and run, abandoned his job and found another. But instead, his marriage of convenience with the metro developed into a passionate love affair. When he'd had his fill of wandering around the tunnels on foot, he underwent the rites of initiation as a driver's mate and established himself in a more solid position in the complex hierarchy of the Metropolitan. And the better he got to know this unacknowledged wonder of the world, this labyrinth with a nostalgic yen for antiquity, this ownerless,
cyclopean city that was an inverted reflection in the brown Moscow earth of its prototype up above, the more deeply and selflessly he fell in love with it. This man-made Tartarus was indisputably worthy of the poetry of the genuine Homer, or at least the fleet pen of Swift, who would have seen it as a greater joke than Laputa. But the man who became its secret admirer and artless singer was Kolya. Plain, simple, Nikolai Ivanovich Nikolaev. It was absurd. Anyone reading the Russian folk tale The Stone Flower might feel that he could love the mistress of the Copper Mountain, but love the Copper Mountain itself? And yet the day came when Kolya's love was requited with a jealous passion that took away his family, but saved his life. Hunter froze abruptly on the spot, and Homer, hunkered down under his snug feather quilt of memories, had no time to pull back. The old man ran into the brigadier's back at full tilt. Without making a sound, the brigadier flung him aside and froze again, lowering his head and turning his mutilated ear towards the tunnel. Like a bat mapping out space in its blindness, he was picking up wavelengths that only he could hear. But Homer picked up something else. The smell of Nakhimov Prospekt. A smell that was impossible to confuse with any other. They'd certainly got here quickly. He just hoped they wouldn't be made to pay for the ease with which they'd been let through. As if he could hear Homer's thoughts, Ahmed shrugged the submachine gun off his shoulder and clicked off the safety catch.
"Who's that up there?"
Hunter suddenly boomed, turning to the old man. Homer chuckled to himself. Who could tell what hellish beasts they might find? The wide-open gates of Nakhimov Prospekt were like a funnel, sucking in from above creatures that defied the imagination. But the station had its permanent residence, too.
"Small, with no hair,"
said the brigadier, trying to describe them. And that was enough for Homer. It was them.
"Corpse eaters,"
he said in a low voice. From Sebastopol to Tula, and maybe in other parts of the metro as well, this old, clichéd Russian insult now had a different, new meaning. A literal one.
"Predators?"
asked Hunter.
"Scavengers,"
the old man replied indecisively. These repulsive creatures that simultaneously resembled spiders and primates never risked openly attacking human beings, and fed on carrion, dragged down from the surface to the station they had made their own. A large herd of them nested at the Prospekt, and all the tunnels nearby were filled with the sickly sweet stench of decomposition. At the station itself, the sheer pressure of it made men feel dizzy, and many of them found it so unbearable that they pulled on their gas masks on the approaches to the station. Homer, who remembered this distinctive feature of Nakhimov Prospekt only too well, hastily pulled the mask of his respirator out of his knapsack and put it on. Ahmed, who had packed hurriedly, gave Homer an envious glance and covered his face with his sleeve. The repugnant vapors emanating from the station gradually enveloped them, spurring them to move on quickly. But Hunter didn't seem to smell anything.
"Something poisonous. Spores?"
he asked Homer.
"The smell..."
Homer mumbled through his mask and wrinkled up his face. The brigadier examined the old man searchingly, as if trying to work out if Homer was making fun of him, then shrugged his massive broad shoulders.
"The usual,"
he said, and turned away. He shifted his grip on his short automatic, beckoned for them to follow him, and moved on ahead, stepping softly. About 50 steps further on, the hideous stench was joined by an obscure murmuring. Homer wiped away the perspiration that had started streaming down his forehead and tried to curb the galloping pace of his heartbeat. They were really close now. The groping flashlight beam finally found something. It swept the darkness off broken headlights peering blindly into nowhere, off the glass of dusty windscreens cobwebbed with cracks, off light blue metal paneling that stubbornly refused to rust. There ahead of them was the first carriage of a train that blocked the throat of the tunnel like a gigantic cork. The train had died ages ago. It was beyond all hope, but every time he saw it, Homer felt like a little boy. He wanted to climb into the devastated cabin, caress the keys and switches of the instrument panel, close his eyes and pretend that once again he was dashing through the tunnels at full speed, pulling behind him a string of brightly lit carriages filled with people, reading, dozing, gazing at advertisements, or struggling to make conversation above the rumble of the engines.
"If the alarm signal Atom is given, drive to the nearest station, stop there, and open the doors. Assist the efforts of civil defense units and the army to evacuate the injured and seal off the stations of the Metropolitan."
The instructions on what train drivers should do on Judgment Day were precise and simple. Wherever it was possible, they were carried out. Most of the trains that froze at the platforms of the stations had fallen into a lethargic sleep, and gradually been cannibalized for spare parts by the inhabitants of the Metro, who, instead of spending a few weeks in this refuge as promised, had been detained here for all eternity. In a few places the trains had been preserved and converted into homes, but that seemed blasphemous to Homer, who had always seen trains as possessing a distinctly animate essence. It was like having your favorite pet cat stuffed and mounted. In places that were unfit for human habitation, like Nakhimov Prospekt, the trains stood, gnawed on by time and vandals, but still intact. Homer simply couldn't take his eyes off the carriage. A phantom alarm signal wailed in his ears, drowning out the ever louder rustling and hissing sounds from the station, and a deep, low siren blasted out the signal that had never been heard before that day. One long blast, and two short ones. "Ah, Tom!" A lingering clang of brakes and a bewildered announcement in all the carriages.
"Ladies and gentlemen, for technical reasons, this train will not proceed any further."
It was too soon yet for the driver mumbling into the microphone, or Homer, his mate, to grasp the anguished hopelessness of those hackneyed words. The rasping sound of hermetic doors straining shut, separating off the world of the living from the world of the dead forever. According to instructions, the gates had to be finally locked no later than 6 minutes after the alarm was sounded, no matter how many people were left on the other side. If anyone tried to prevent the gates closing, the recommendation was to shoot at them. Would a little police sergeant, who guarded his station against homeless bums and drunks, be able to shoot a man in the stomach because he was trying to hold back the immense metal behemoth in order to give his wife, who had broken her heel, time to run inside? Would a high-handed turnstile woman in a round uniform cap, who had spent her 30-year career in the Metro perfecting two skills, not letting people through and blowing her whistle, be able to refuse entrance to a desperately panting old man with a pathetic row of medal ribbons? The instructions gave them only 6 minutes to change from a human being into a machine or a monster. Women squealing, men clamoring indignantly, children sobbing desperately. The staccato popping of pistol shots and rumbling bursts of automatic fire, recorded appeals to remain calm, relayed through every speaker in a metallic, passionless voice. They had to be recorded because no human being knowing what was happening could possibly have kept his presence of mind and simply said it like that indifferently, "Do not panic." Tears. Prayers. More shooting. And precisely 6 minutes after the alarm, 1 minute before Armageddon, the rumbling funereal clang as sections of hermetic doors lock together, the reverberating clicks of the bolts. Silence. The silence of the crypt. They had to walk along the wall past the carriage. The driver had braked too late. Perhaps he had been distracted by what was happening at that moment on the platform. They clambered up a cast-iron ladder, and a moment later they were standing in an amazingly spacious hall. No columns, just the half-cylinder of a single semicircular vault, with egg-shaped recesses behind the lamps. An immense vault, arching over the platform and both tracks together with the train standing on them. The structure is incredibly elegant. Simple, divinely light and uncluttered. Only don't look down at your feet, at the floor ahead of you. Don't let yourself see what the station has been turned into now. This grotesque graveyard, where no rest could possibly be found, this
macabre meat market piled high with gnawed skeletons, rotten carcasses, chunks ripped off someone's trunk. The vile creatures have greedily dragged in here everything they could grab anywhere within their extensive domain, more than they can devour immediately. Reserves for future use. These reserves putrefy and decompose, but the brutes carry on accumulating them incessantly. In defiance of the laws of nature, the heaps of dead meat moved as if they were breathing, and a repulsive scraping sound could be heard on all sides. The beam of light picked out one of the strange figures, long, knotty limbs, flabby, grey, hairless skin hanging down in folds, a crooked spine, dull eyes blinking weakly, immense ears moving as if they had a life of their own. One creature gave a hoarse cry and trudged unhurriedly to the open doors of a carriage, stepping with all four of its arm legs. Other corpse-eaters started climbing down off other heaps in the same lazy fashion, hissing indignantly, sniffling, baring their teeth and snarling at the travellers. Standing erect, they barely came up to Homer's chest, and he was short. He also knew perfectly well that the beasts were cowardly, that they were unlikely to attack a strong, healthy man. But the irrational horror that Homer felt at the sight of the creatures was rooted in nightmares in which he lay all alone, exhausted and abandoned in a deserted station, and the beasts were creeping ever closer, like sharks in the ocean, who can scent a drop of blood from kilometers away. These creatures could sense the approach of death, and they hurried to be there when it arrived. Senile anxiety, Homer told himself contemptuously. He had once read a whole raft of textbooks on applied psychology, but that wasn't much help to him now. The corpse-eaters weren't afraid of people. Using up ammunition on the repulsive but apparently harmless devourers of carrion would have been regarded as criminal waste at Sebastopol. The convoys passing through tried not to take any notice of them, although sometimes the corpse-eaters behaved provocatively. They had bred in huge numbers here. And as the three men moved further in, crushing someone's small bones under their boots with a sickening crunch at every step, more and more of the beasts reluctantly tore themselves away from their feasting and wandered off into cover. Their nests were in the trains, and Homer loathed them even more for that. The hermetic doors at Nakhimov Prospect were open. It was believed that if you moved through the station quickly, the small dose of radiation you received was no danger to health, but it was forbidden to halt here. That was why both of the trains were relatively well preserved. The windows were all in place. The stained and soiled seats could be seen through the open doors. The light blue paint showed no signs of peeling off the metal flanks. Towering up in the middle of the hall was a genuine burial mound, built from the twisted skeletons of unknown creatures. As he drew level with it, Hunter suddenly stopped. Ahmed and Homer glanced at each other in alarm, trying to work out where any danger could come from. But the reason for the halt turned out to be something different. At the foot of the mound, two small corpse-eaters were stripping a dog skeleton, champing and growling with relish as they ate. They hadn't hidden in time. Either they were too absorbed in their meal and didn't notice the signals from other members of their tribe, or they simply hadn't been able to control their greed. They screwed up their eyes in the glare of the brigadier's flashlight and carried on chewing, starting to withdraw slowly in the direction of the nearest carriage, but suddenly, one after another, they somersaulted backwards and flopped down onto the floor like empty sacks. Homer gazed in amazement at Hunter, who was putting a heavy army pistol with a long cylindrical silencer back in his shoulder holster. His face was as inscrutable and lifeless as ever.
"They must have been very hungry, I suppose,"
Ahmed muttered under his breath, examining the dark puddles spreading out from under the dead beast's smashed skulls with squeamish interest.
"So am I,"
the brigadier responded incomprehensibly, making Homer shudder. Hunter moved on without looking round at the others, and old Homer thought he could hear that low, greedy growling again. What an effort it cost him every time to resist the temptation to put a bullet into these vermin. He had to coax himself,
calm himself down, and eventually he got the upper hand and demonstrated to himself that he was a mature individual who could tame his nightmares, who refused to let them drive him insane. But Hunter apparently had no intention of even trying to fight his impulsive desires. Only what were those desires? The silent demise of two members of the herd galvanized the other corpse-eaters, scenting fresh death. Even the boldest and the laziest of them moved off the platforms, wheezing and whining faintly. They crammed into both trains and fell silent, lined up at the windows and crowding in the doors of the carriages. These creatures didn't show any rage or desire for revenge. Once the team left the station, they would immediately devour their own dead relatives.
"Aggression is a quality of hunters," thought Homer. "Those who feed on carrion don't need it, just as they don't need to kill. Everything living dies sooner or later. It will all become their food anyway. All they have to do is wait."
The beam of the flashlight revealed the repulsive faces pressed up against the other side of the dirty, greenish panes of glass, the misshapen bodies, the clawed hands groping restlessly at the inside of the satanic fish tank. In total silence, hundreds of pairs of dull eyes doggedly followed the movement of the team as it walked by, the creatures' heads turning uncannily in precise synchronization, watching intently as the men moved away. The little freaks, sealed in flasks of formalin at the Kunstkamera Museum, would have watched the visitors like that if their eyelids hadn't prudently been sewn shut. Despite the approaching hour of reckoning for his godlessness, Homer still couldn't bring himself to believe in either the Lord or the devil. But if purgatory did exist, this was exactly how it would have looked for the old man. Sisyphus was doomed to battle against gravity. Tantalus was condemned to the torment of unquenchable thirst. But waiting for Homer at the station of his death was a train driver's jacket, and this blood-curdling ghost train with its monstrous gargoyle passengers, the mockery of vengeful gods. And on leaving the platform, the train would drive straight into one of the old legends of the metro, with the tunnel looping round into a Mobius strip, a dragon devouring its own tail. Hunter had lost interest in the station and its inhabitants, and the team crossed the rest of the hall at a brisk pace. Ahmed and Homer could hardly keep up with the brigadier's impetuous stride. The old man felt the urge to turn round, shout, fire, to scatter these insolent freaks and banish his own painful thoughts. But instead he trudged on with his head lowered, concentrating hard to avoid stepping on anybody's rotting remains. Ahmed hung his head too, absorbed in his own thoughts. And in their hasty flight from Nakhimov Prospekt, no one thought of looking round any longer. The patch of light from Hunter's flashlight scurried rapidly from side to side, as if it were following an invisible gymnast under the dome of this baleful circus. But even the brigadier was no longer taking any notice of what it picked out. A set of fresh bones and a half-gnawed skull, clearly human, glinted briefly in the beam, and immediately disappeared back into the gloom, unnoticed by anyone. Lying beside them like a useless shell were a steel army helmet and a bulletproof vest. Over the peeling green paint of the helmet, a single word had been stenciled in white. Sebastopol. Chapter 4. Tangled Knots.
"Dad. Dad, it's me, Sasha."
She carefully loosened the tight canvas strap restraining the terribly bloated chin and removed her father's helmet. Thrusting her fingers into his sweat-soaked hair, she hooked out the strip of rubber, pulled off his gas mask, and flung it aside like a ghastly, shriveled grey scalp. His chest heaved painfully, his fingers scrabbled at the granite floor, and his watery eyes stared at her without blinking. But he didn't answer. Sasha put the knapsack under his head and dashed to the door. Bracing her skinny shoulder against the enormous panel of metal, she took a deep, deep breath and gritted her teeth. The massive slab yielded reluctantly and scraped into place with a low grunt. Sasha clanged the bolt home and slid down onto the floor. A minute.
just one little minute to catch her breath, and then she'd go straight back to him. Every new expedition drained more of her father's strength, and the meager pickings he came back with couldn't compensate for the loss. These sallies were draining away what was left of his life, not by the day, but whole weeks and months at a time. An exorbitant price that had to be paid. If they didn't have anything to sell, they'd have no choice left but to eat their tame rat, the only one in this godforsaken death trap of a station, and then shoot themselves. Sasha wanted to take her father's place. So many times she had asked him for the respirator, so that she could go up there, but he was adamant. Probably he knew the filters on the leaky gas mask had been blocked for so long, it was no more use now than any other good luck charm. But he never admitted that to her. He lied about knowing how to clean the filters. He lied about feeling fine after an hour's stroll. He lied about simply wanting to be alone when he was afraid that she would see him vomiting blood. Sasha was powerless to change anything. They had driven her father and her into this corner, and if they hadn't finished them off, it was more out of contemptuous curiosity than pity. They hadn't expected the two of them to last more than a week, but her father's willpower and sheer grit had kept them going for years. Although they were hated and despised, they were given food regularly, but not, of course, for free. In the breaks between expeditions, in those rare moments when the two of them sat together beside the stunted, smoky little campfire, her father liked to tell her about the way things used to be before. He had realized years ago that there was no point in lying to himself any longer. He had no future. But no one could take away his past.
"I used to have eyes the same color as yours," he told her, "the color of the sky."
And Sasha thought she could remember those days, too. The days before the gigantic tumor swelled up on his neck, before his eyes faded and turned colorless, when they were still as bright as her own were now. When her father said, "the color of the sky," of course he meant the azure sky that lived on in his memory, not the crimson sky that eddied and swirled above him when he went up there at night. He hadn't seen daylight for more than 20 years. Sasha had never seen it, except in her dreams. But how could she be sure the way she imagined it was right? Is the world that people blind from birth see in their dreams like ours? And do they see it all, even in their dreams? When little children squeeze their eyes shut, they think darkness has swallowed up the entire world. They think everyone else around them is as blind as they are at that moment.
"In the tunnels, a man is as helpless and naive as those children," thought Homer. "He can click his flashlight on and off as much as he likes, imagining that he's the master of light and darkness. But even the very blackest darkness around him can be full of seeing eyes."
This thought haunted Homer now, after their brush with the scavengers. He had to take his mind off it somehow, distract himself.
"Strange that Hunter didn't know what to expect at Nahimov Prospect," he thought.
When the brigadier first appeared at Sebastopol 2 months earlier, none of the sentries could explain how a man with such a massive figure could have slipped past all the guard posts set up in the northern tunnels without being noticed. Thankfully, the perimeter commander hadn't asked the duty sentries for any explanations. But if he didn't come through Nakhimov Prospect, how had Hunter got to Sebastopol? The other routes to the greater metro had been cut off ages ago. The only exception was the abandoned Kharkovka line, where no living creature had been seen in the tunnels for many years. And for good reason. Chertanovo? It was ridiculous to suppose that even such a skilled and ruthless warrior could have made his way alone through that cursed station, and it was impossible to get to it without showing up at Sebastopol first. If the north and the south were excluded, Homer could only assume their mysterious visitor had reached the station from above. Naturally, all the known ways in from the surface and back out to it were thoroughly sealed off and guarded, but still, could he, for instance, have opened a blocked ventilation shaft? The Sebastopolites thought there was no way the scorched ruins of the concrete slab high-rises could still throw up someone intelligent enough to disconnect their alarm system. The boundless patchwork chessboard of residential districts was carved apart by fragments of the warheads that fell on the city, and it had been empty for a long, long time. The last human players had abandoned it decades ago, and the horrific, malformed chess figures that roamed across its surface now were playing a new game by their own rules. Man couldn't even dream of getting a return match. Brief excursions in search of anything valuable that hadn't rotted away in more than 20 years, hasty and humiliating attempts to pillage their own homes, that was all people had the strength for now. Encased in their anti-radiation armor, the stalkers went up there to ransack the skeletons of the nearby low Khrushchev-era buildings for the 100th time, but they shied away from decisive combat with the new landlords. The most they could do was fire a snarling burst of automatic fire and sit it out in the apartments polluted with rat droppings until the danger had passed, then make a headlong dash for the underground. The old maps of the capital had lost all resemblance to reality a long time ago. Where once there were wide avenues choked with traffic jams several kilometers long, now there might be gaping precipices or dark, impassable forest thickets. Entire residential areas had been swallowed up by swamps or scorched bald patches. The most reckless stalkers investigated the surface within a radius of up to 1 kilometer from their home burrows. Others were far less ambitious. The stations that followed Nakhimov Prospekt, Nagornaya, Nagatino, and Chula, had no exits of their own, and in any case the people living at two of them were too timid to go up onto the surface. It was a mystery to Homer where a living man could have come from in the middle of this wasteland, but he would still have liked to think that Hunter came to their station from the surface, because there was one other final possibility for the route the Brigadier had followed to reach them, and this possibility came creeping into the godless old man's mind against his will, while he was trying to control his panting breath and keep up with that dark silhouette, rushing ahead so furiously that its feet didn't even seem to touch the ground. From below.
"I've got a bad feeling about this,"
Ahmed murmured slowly, just loud enough for Homer to make out his words, but too softly for the Brigadier, who had pulled ahead slightly, to hear.
"We've picked the wrong time. Believe me, I've been in plenty of convoys here. This is a bad day at Nagornaya."
It was a long time since the bands of petty robbers who rested from their plunder at dark way stations as far away as possible from the circle had dared to come anywhere near the Sebastopol convoys. When they heard the regular tramping of metal-tipped boots announce the heavy infantry's approach, the only thought in their minds was how to get out of the way as quickly as possible. No, they weren't the reason why the convoys were always so well guarded. And it wasn't because of the four-handed scavengers at Nakhimov Prospekt, either. Iron discipline and audacious courage, with the ability to close ranks into a wall of steel in seconds and exterminate any tangible threat with a withering hail of fire, would have made the Sebastopol convoys masters of the tunnels from their own guard posts all the way to Serpukhov, if not for Nagornaya. Nakhimov Prospekt and all its horrors were behind them now, but neither Homer nor Ahmed felt even a moment's relief. Nagornaya station, so plain and unassuming, had been the end of the line for many travellers who failed to take it seriously enough. The poor souls at the next station, Nagatino, huddled as far away as possible from the greedy jaws of the tunnel that led south to Nagornaya, as if that could protect them. As if what crept out of the southern tunnel to garner its harvest wouldn't bother to prowl a little further in search of prey that suited its taste. Travelling through Nagornaya station, you always had to trust to luck. The place was so capricious and inconsistent. Sometimes it let travellers pass, merely frightening them with the bloody stains on its walls and fluted steel columns, as if someone had tried to escape by climbing up them. But the reception it gave the next group, literally only minutes later, would make the survivors think the loss of only half their comrades was a victory. It could never be sated. It had no favorites. It defied observation and study. For the inhabitants of all the stations around it, Nagornaya embodied the whim of fate. and it was the greatest ordeal of all for men who set out on the journey from Sebastopol to the Circle and back.
Nagornaya couldn't have done it all on its own.
Ahmed was superstitious, like many of the Sebastopolites, and he always spoke about this station as a living creature. Homer didn't need to ask what he meant. He had also been wondering how Nagornaya Station could have swallowed up the convoys that had disappeared and all the scouts sent out to search for them.
All sorts of things have happened, but for so many men to disappear at once, he agreed, it would have choked on them. Don't talk like that,
Ahmed exclaimed, clicking his tongue angrily at Homer and flinging his hands up in alarm. Or perhaps he was holding back the slap that the old man was obviously asking for.
It won't choke on you, that's for sure.
Homer let that go, and reined in his resentment. He didn't believe Nagornaya could hear what they said and hold it against them. Not at this distance, anyway. Superstition. It was sheer superstition. If you tried to pay homage to all the idols of the underworld, you were bound to fail. You couldn't avoid offending someone. Homer had stopped worrying about that kind of thing long ago, but Ahmed thought differently. He pulled a set of prayer beads, made of blunt pistol bullets, out of the pocket of his uniform jacket pocket, and started twirling the string of lead through his dirty hands and fluttering his lips, praying in his own language to atone for Homer's offences against Nagornaya. But the station didn't seem to understand him. Or perhaps it was already too late for apologies. Hunter detected something with his supernatural sense of smell and waved his gloved hand, killing the pace. He sank down slowly onto the ground.
There is fog up there, he said curtly. What's that?
Homer and Ahmed exchanged glances. They both understood what it meant. The hunt was on, and now they would need all their luck to reach the northern limits of Nagornaya alive.
How can I put it?
Ahmed replied reluctantly.
It's breathing.
What is?
The brigadier asked him coolly and shook his knapsack off his shoulders, evidently planning to select the appropriate caliber from his arsenal.
Nagornaya Station,
said Ahmed, switching to a whisper.
We'll see about that,
Hunter said with a contemptuous, crooked grin. But no. Homer had only imagined the brigadier's mutilated face coming to life. It had remained as immobile as ever. The grin was only a trick of the light. 100 meters further on, the other two saw it. A heavy white mist creeping over the ground towards them, first licking at their boots, then twining round their knees, then flooding the tunnel waist high. It was as if they were slowly walking into a cold, hostile, ghostly sea, sinking deeper and deeper with every step they took across its deceptively sloping bottom until they were totally submerged in its murky waters. They couldn't see a thing. The flashlight beams got stuck in this strange mist like flies in a cobweb. They forced their way a few steps forward, then ran out of strength, went limp, and hung there in midair, feeble, submissive captives. Sounds were hard to make out, as if they were forcing their way through a feather mattress, and it even became harder to move, as if the team really was walking over a silty seabed, not a line of railway sleepers. It got harder to breathe, too. But not because of the humidity. It was the unusual tart aroma that had appeared in the air. The men felt reluctant to let it into their lungs. It made them feel as if they were drawing into themselves the breath of some huge alien creature that had already extracted all the oxygen from the air and saturated it with poisonous exhalations. To be on the safe side, Homer pulled his respirator back over his face. Hunter gave him a quick glance, then lowered his hand into the canvas bag hanging under his shoulder, tugged open a strap and slapped a new rubber mask over his usual one. Ahmed was the only one left without a gas mask. He had either forgotten it in his haste, or decided not to bother. The brigadier froze again, pointing his tattered ear towards Nagornaya, but in the dense white murk he couldn't make out the snatches of sound coming from the station clearly enough to assemble them into a complete picture. Something really massive seemed to tumble over with a crash. Someone gave a long whoop on a note too low for a man or for any kind of animal. There was a hysterical scraping of metal, as if a hand was tying one of the thick pipes running along the wall into a knot. Hunter tossed his head, as if he were throwing off some kind of dirt that was sticking to it, and the short automatic pistol in his hand was replaced by a military Kalashnikov, with twin clips and an under-barrel grenade launcher. At last, he murmured to himself. They reached the station without even realizing it. Nagornaya was flooded with fog as thick as pig's milk. Gazing at it through the misted lenses of his gas mask, Homer felt like a scuba diver who had swum into a sunken ocean liner. The similarity was emphasized by the embossed panels decorating the walls, seagulls imprinted into metal by a crude, artless Soviet stamp. More than anything else, they resembled the imprints of fossilized organisms exposed on the ruptured surfaces of rock strata.
"Fossilization, that's the fate of man and his creations," Homer thought briefly. "But who'll dig them up?"
The miasma filling the air around them was alive. It flowed and quivered. Sometimes patches of darkness condensed out of it. At first, Homer thought he saw a mangled and twisted carriage for a rusty sentry box, and then it was the scaly body or head of some mythical monster. He was afraid even to imagine who might have occupied the crew's quarters, and settled into the first-class cabins in the decades that had passed since the shipwreck. He'd heard a lot about things that had happened at Nagornaya, but he'd never come face to face with...
"There it is, over there, on the right!"
yelled Ahmed, tugging the old man by the sleeve. There was the muffled pop of a shot fired through a homemade silencer. Homer swung round at a speed that was impossible with his rheumatism, but his blunted flashlight lit up nothing except a section of column faced with ribbed metal.
"Behind us! There, behind us!"
Ahmed fired a short burst, but his bullets merely crumbled the remnants of marble slabs that had once covered the walls of the station. Whatever features Ahmed had spotted in the trembling mirage, their owner had dissolved back into it unharmed.
"He's breathed too much of this stuff," thought Homer.
And then out of the very corner of his eye, he saw something. Gigantic. Hunched over. Because the station's 15-foot ceiling was too low for it, something unbelievably agile for its immense size, breaking out of the fog on the very boundary of visibility and swaying back in again before the old man could train his automatic on it. Homer looked round helplessly for the brigadier. He was nowhere to be seen.
"Okay, okay, don't worry," her father reassured her, halting to rest between the words. "You know, somewhere in the metro right now there are people who are far more afraid."
He tried to smile, but it turned out terrifying, like a skull with a jaw that has come adrift. Sasha smiled back, but a salty dewdrop crept down across her sharp, soot-stained cheekbone. At least her father had come round, and the few hours that seemed so long had given her time to think everything through again.
"A real failure this time. I'm so sorry," he said. "I decided to go to the garages after all, but it turned out to be too far. I found one completely untouched. A stainless steel castle, covered in oil. I couldn't break in. So I attached the charge, the last one. I was hoping there'd be a car inside, spare parts. And when I blasted it open, it was empty. Nothing at all. So why did they lock it, the bastards? And that thunderous noise, I was praying no one would hear. Then I walked out of the garage and I was surrounded by dogs on all sides. I thought that was it. I thought I was done for."
Her father lowered his eyelids and stopped talking. Feeling alarmed, Sasha grabbed hold of his hand, but he just swayed his head gently without opening his eyes, as if to tell her, "Don't worry, everything's okay." He was too weak even to speak, but he wanted to tell her how it happened. He needed to explain why he'd come back empty-handed, why they would have a tough week now until he got back on his feet. But sleep overcame him before he could tell her. Sasha checked the bandage wrapped round his torn calf. It was soaked through with black blood, and changed the compress that was already hot. She straightened up, went over to the rat's little house and opened the tiny door a crack. The little beast peeped out warily and hid again. And then it did what Sasha was hoping for and scrabbled out onto the platform to stretch its legs. The rat's intuition never let it down. The tunnels were quiet. Reassured, the girl went back to the stretcher bed.
"You will definitely get up. You'll walk again,"
she whispered to her father.
"And you'll find a garage with an entire car in it, all in one piece. And we'll go up there together, get into it and drive far away from here. 10, 15 stations away, to where no one knows us, where we'll be strangers, where no one will hate us. If there is a place like that anywhere."
She was telling him the same magical fairy tale that she had heard from him so often, repeating it word for word. And now, as she recited this old mantra of her father's, she believed in it 100 times more powerfully. She would nurse him back to health. She would cure him. There was a place in this world where no one could give a damn about them. A place where they could be happy.
"There it is! There! It's looking at me!"
Ahmed squealed as if he had already been seized and dragged away. He screamed as he had never allowed himself to scream before. His automatic roared again, then stuttered and choked. Ahmed's usual composure deserted him completely, and he trembled violently as he tried to insert a full clip into the slot.
"It's chosen me! Me!"
Somewhere nearby, another automatic barked briefly, fell silent for a second, and then chattered again in clipped, 3-shot bursts. Hunter was still alive, after all, so there was still hope. The chattering moved away and then came closer, but it was impossible to tell if the bullets had found their mark. Homer strained his ears in vain for the furious roar of a wounded monster. The station was enveloped in oppressive silence. Its mysterious residents seemed to be either immaterial or invulnerable. Now the Brigadier was waging his strange battle at the far end of the platform, where fiery strings of tracer bullets repeatedly flared up and faded away. Enthralled by his fight with phantoms, he had abandoned his men to their fate. Homer took a deep breath and looked up, cautiously giving in to the desire that had been tormenting him for several long moments already. He could feel that gaze all too clearly with his skin, the top of his head, the fine hairs on his neck, a cold, leaden, crushing gaze, and he couldn't fight his foreboding any longer. Right up under the ceiling, high above their heads, another head was hovering in the fog, a head so immense that at first Homer didn't realize what he was looking at. The titanic creature's body remained hidden in the dense gloom of the station, leaving its monstrous face suspended, swaying in the air above the tiny little men brandishing their useless weapons. Strangely, it seemed in no hurry to attack, allowing them a brief respite. Numb with horror, the old man sank to his knees, resigned to his fate, and the automatic rifle tumbled out of his hands, clanking pitifully against a rail. Ahmed howled and screeched hideously. The creature shifted forward effortlessly, and all the space in front of them was blotted out by its dark body, as huge as a cliff. Homer closed his eyes, readying himself, saying goodbye. He had only one thought left, one regret, a bitter thought searing through his mind. "I haven't finished yet." And at that very moment the grenade launcher spat fire and the pressure wave slammed into his ears, deafening them, leaving behind a subtle whistling sound that went on and on. Gobbets of burnt flesh came showering down. Ahmed, the first to gather his wits, tugged the old man to his feet by the scruff of his neck and dragged him away. They ran forward, stumbling over sleepers and getting up again without feeling any pain. They clung to each other because it was impossible to make out anything through the milky haze, even at arm's length. They raced along as if it was not mere death pursuing them, but something infinitely more terrible, the final extinction and utter annihilation of their bodies and souls. Demons pursued them, invisible and almost completely silent, but only one step behind, escorting them without attacking, toying with them, allowing them the illusion of escape. Then the chipped marble walls gave way to the lining of the tunnel. They'd made it through Nagornaya, and the guardians of the station were left behind, as if they had reached the limit of the chains to which they were attached. But it was still too soon to stop, Ahmed strode on in front, feeling for the pipes on the walls, groping for the way ahead and goading on the old man who was stumbling along and kept trying to sit down.
"What happened to the brigadier?"
Homer croaked, tearing off his stifling gas mask as he walked.
"When the fog ends, we'll stop and wait. That must be soon now, very soon. Only another 200 meters. Get out of the fog. The important thing is to get out of the fog,"
Ahmed kept intoning.
"I'm going to count the steps."
But after 200 steps, and even after 300, the haze enveloping them was still as dense as ever.
"What if it's spread all the way to Nagatino?" thought Homer. "What if it's already gobbled up Tula and Nakhimov Prospect?"
"It's not possible. I must... not far to go now,"
Ahmed mumbled for the 100th time, and suddenly froze on the spot. Homer ran into him, and they both tumbled to the ground.
"There's no more wall,"
said Ahmed, stroking the sleepers, the rails, the rough, damp concrete of the floor in dumb bewilderment, as if afraid that any moment now the ground would treacherously slip away from under his feet in the same way as his other support had vanished.
"Here it is. What's wrong with you?"
said Homer, groping around for the slope of a tunnel liner, then grabbing hold of it and cautiously getting to his feet.
"Sorry,"
said Ahmed, and paused, gathering his thoughts.
"You know, back there at the station, I thought I'd never get away from the place. The way it was looking at me. Looking at me, you know? It had decided to take me. I thought I'd be left there forever, and never buried."
He had to struggle to force the words out. He didn't want to let them out for a long time. He was ashamed of screaming like a woman. He wanted to make excuses, and he knew there couldn't be any excuses. Homer shook his head.
"Drop it. I pissed my pants, and it's not bothering me any. Come on. We must be almost there now."
The pursuit had been called off. They could get their breath back. They couldn't run any longer in any case, and they wandered along, clutching at the walls as blindly as ever. Advancing towards deliverance, step by step. The worst of the terror was behind them, and although the murk was still not receding, sooner or later the predatory drafts of the tunnels would bite into it, shred it, and drag the shreds into the ventilation shafts. Sooner or later they would reach a place where there were more people, and wait there for their delayed commander. It happened sooner than they could possibly have hoped, maybe because time and space were both distorted in the fog. A cast-iron ladder appeared, running up the wall onto a platform. The round cross-section of the tunnel gave way to a right-angled one, and a hollow appeared between the rails, a safe refuge for passengers who fell into the track.
"Look at that," whispered Homer. "It looks like a station. A station."
"Hey, is there anyone there?"
Ahmed yelled as loud as he could.
"Hey, lads, is anyone there?"
he yelled, overwhelmed by senseless, triumphant laughter. The yellowish, exhausted beams of their flashlights picked slabs of marble, gnawed away by time and people out of the hazy gloom. Not one of the bright-colored mosaics, the pride and joy of Nagatino, had survived. And what had become of the stone-faced columns? Could this really be? No one answered Ahmed, but he didn't despair and carried on calling cheerfully. It was obvious enough. The people had taken fright at the fog and run off. But they couldn't fool him like that. Meanwhile, Homer kept searching anxiously for something on the walls, licking at them with his fading beam of light, while suspicion chilled his blood. And then at last he found it. Iron letters screwed into the cracked marble. Nagornaya. Her father believed it was never accidental when people went back to a place. They returned in order to change something, in order to put something right. Sometimes, he believed, God himself takes us by the scruff of the neck and brings us back to the spot where we accidentally escaped his watchful eye, in order to enforce his sentence, or give us a second chance. That was why he explained he would never be able to return from exile to their native station. He had no strength left to take revenge, to struggle, to prove anything. He had long ago stopped wanting anyone's contrition or remorse. In the old story that had cost him his former life and almost ended his life completely, everyone had got what they deserved, he said. As things turned out, they had been condemned to eternal exile. Sasha's father didn't want to put anything right, and in any case the Lord never called into this station. The rescue plan to find a car that hadn't rotted away in over 2 decades, repair it, fuel it, and break out of the narrow circle in which fate had imprisoned them. That plan had been no more than a bedtime story for a long time already. For Sasha, there was another way back to the greater metro. When she went down to the bridge on the set day to exchange the clumsily repaired devices, blackened jewelry and moldy books for food and a few cartridges. Sometimes they offered her a lot more. Training the trolley's searchlight on her slightly angular, boyish figure, the shuttle traders winked at each other and smacked their lips, beckoning to her and shouting promises. The little girl seemed wild. She glowered at them with her head down, tensed up like a spring, concealing a long-bladed knife behind her back. The loose-fitting man's overalls couldn't blur the bold, clear lines of her body. The mud and engine oil on her face only made her blue eyes shine even more brightly, so brightly that some men turned their own eyes away. The white hair, artlessly trimmed with the same knife that was always clutched in her right hand, barely covered her ears. The gnawed lips never smiled. Soon, realizing that pretty gifts were poor bait for taming a wild wolf, the men on the trolley tried to bribe her with freedom, but she never answered them even once. They decided the girl must be dumb. It was easier like that. Sasha knew perfectly well that no matter what she agreed to, she could never buy 2 places on the trolley. People had too many accounts for her father to settle, and they couldn't possibly be paid. Faceless, and with adenoidal voices in their black military gas masks, they weren't simply enemies to her. She couldn't see anything human about them, not a single thing that could have set her dreaming, not even at night, even in her dreams. And so she simply set the telephones, irons, and kettles down on the sleepers, moved back 10 steps and waited for the shuttle traders to take the goods, fling the bundles of dried pork down on the track, and toss her a handful of cartridges, deliberately scattering them out of spite, so they could watch as she collected them, crawling on her hands and knees. Then the trolley slowly sailed off into a different world, and Sasha turned around and went home, where a heap of broken household appliances was waiting for her, along with a screwdriver, a soldering iron, and an old bicycle converted into a generator. She mounted